Welcome to episode 41 of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hi, and I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems.
So on this podcast, we're going to highlight poems for you that stands for patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want all the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you not only get one of our poems every day, but also a great primary care reference designed for primary care physicians and written by largely primary care physicians. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. It's only $89 a year, and you can be guaranteed of keeping up with the most important research. The opinions expressed on the Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. Henry had a comment he wanted to share with us. Henry, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, so we're recording on Doctor's Day, and I just wanted to express our gratitude to all of our frontline healthcare workers, all of our colleagues and friends, for your altruism, bravery, your kindness, and professionalism are all on full display during these extraordinary times.
And I'll add that that includes, of course, not only primary care physicians, but nurse practitioners, PAs, nurses, medical assistants, laboratory personnel, students, learners, residents who are all out there working together. So well said. So our first poem is going to be some updates on some recent COVID-19 research. These have not yet been written up as poems, but they are brief updates. We're going to be posting these as well. We're going to try to figure out a way to send these out weekly with the poems emails that you get, as well as some of them are going to be posted at the American Family Physician website. So the first one is a case series from JAMA that was just published. And this is the first study of convalescent sera. And it was a case series in China of five patients with severe COVID-19 pneumonia and ARDS who were mechanically ventilated. They were all given convalescent sera. Fever resolved in 4 out of 5 patients within 3 days. ARDS resolved in 4 out of 5 patients by 12 days after the transfusion. At the time that they wrote this report a few days ago, 3 had been discharged from the hospital and 2 were in stable condition. Clearly, this is promising. It's, you know, good to hear some positive news. But obviously, we need clinical trials given the small number of patients and the uncontrolled design. The second was a study also out of China from Shanghai, and it was a small randomized trial published in the Journal of Zhejiang, and I hope I'm not slaughtering that, university, published in mid-March 2020. It was a randomized trial. 30 patients with COVID-19 were randomized to hydroxychloroquine, 400 milligrams once a day for 5 days, plus usual care versus usual care alone. After 7 days, there was unfortunately no difference in the rates of negative viral swabs, which was about 90% in both groups, no difference in incidence of severe disease, only one case, and that was in the hydroxychloroquine group, no difference in time to discharge or time to being afebrile. So larger trials are underway. I think there are 23 randomized trials underway of these drugs in China. Many, many, many other randomized trials are underway. We're starting to see some of those early reports, which we will bring to you. This one is not encouraging about hydroxychloroquine, and larger trials are needed. We need some, you know, perhaps this could have been given at a different stage in the disease and been more effective. Perhaps it was the dose issue. We don't really know. But in this trial, at least, it wasn't effective. And the last one is from a preprint server. So one of the things we're going to occasionally bring you are studies that have not gone through peer review. We obviously don't usually do that, but in this time when we need rapid information, researchers are posting their research paper. They're submitting it to a journal, but then they're also putting it up on what we call a preprint server. And this one is run by British Medical Journal and Cold Spring Harbor National Laboratory, and I think Yale University. It's called the MedRxIV, MedRxIV, if you want to check it out yourself. Anyway, this study looked at can we predict who's going to have a worse prognosis? And that's going to be an important question. You know, if I see a patient in my office, who can go home? Who should I send to the hospital? Who needs closer follow-up? Who can probably be more or less left alone? So what they used was data from 577 patients in Wuhan City, China. They identified 2 risk factors. One was age over 60, and one was CRP over 34, C-reactive protein. So basically a low-risk group was somebody who was under 60 with a CRP less than 34. The moderate risk group, and they had a 0% mortality, by the way. The moderate risk group had a 6% mortality. That included patients who were either over 60 but had a low CRP or under 60 and had a high CRP. And then finally, the high-risk group that had 33% mortality was age greater than 60 and CRP greater than 34. There have been several other studies, three or four that I've seen on this preprint server, that have also found that CRP is consistently a good predictor of a bad outcome. We need predictors of maybe less severe outcomes than mortality, you know, which patients are likely to need hospitalization. Can we predict in a few days from now who's going to be doing poorly? And we'll bring that information to you as it's developed. But for now, elevated CRP, and that's a pretty easy, pretty cheap test to do, and obviously age over 60 are two important risk factors. And somebody who has one of those is at moderate risk. Somebody that has both of them is at high risk and should almost certainly be hospitalized. So, John Henry, any comments on those studies?
Yes, I wanted to comment on the convalescent sera study. Although it is very small, this is quite promising because it doesn't stop with convalescent sera. It's possible then to clone monoclonal antibodies and produce a treatment that could be available on a much wider basis than simply using sera. Those trials are starting already. It's likely it'll be a year down the road, but next year that could be quite an effective treatment. We'll see what happens.
And that's a model that's actually quite old. And if I remember correctly, the model most recently used to develop the monoclonal antibodies against Ebola. So I agree that this is promising and not necessarily a new concept, just a newly applied concept.
Yeah, there have been some other trials, one of combination, some HIV therapy that was ineffective, but that was published in the New England Journal. Some of these other antivirals, and particularly ones used against RNA viruses like Hep B and Hep C, are promising. And again, we're waiting on the results of those trials. I saw one that looked favorable, but it was on the preprint server. And for a treatment trial, I'd prefer to see that get peer reviewed before we, you know, start widely disseminating it.
Yeah, the antimalarials are kind of fascinating because there have been some in vitro studies demonstrating some effect of on cellular uptake and the like, and with regards to SARS virus. And I believe that as of yesterday, the FDA has just given emergency approval for the use of antimalarials, which is a mixed blessing, if you will, because of the strain on supplies. The thing that's often missing, though, are the harms. So the antimalarials and the macrolide antibiotics that people are climbing for, these have the tendency to prolong the QT interval. And in a significant subset of elders who are taking cardiotoxic agents or people with congenital prolonged QT intervals, we know that these don't play well. And the sudden death problems that can arise are things that we just need to be aware that there is a downside to these when we use them as part of a hope and a prayer.
Yeah, something that may be helpful may also not be helpful and may even be harmful. So we always got to keep that in mind. So no quiz this issue. We've got a lot to cover. And I think it's time for Henry's poem.
Yeah, so this next poem asks the question, we're moving away from coronavirus now, asks the question, do adults with midshaft clavicular fractures have better outcomes with surgical treatment than with conservative treatment? This was by Guerra, published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine just this past December. They did a meta-analysis and they looked at multiple databases and registries to try to identify randomized trials of patients who had a midshaft clavicular fracture and that they were either treated surgically or conservatively with some form of immobilization. They found 14 trials. The patients were between 25 and 41 years of age, so a relatively young group. Over 80% were men. So this tells me that women are too smart to get themselves into circumstances where they break their collarbones. Most of the studies, however, were at moderate to high risk of bias, so the methodologic quality wasn't great. What did they find? Well, overall, about a little over 1% of the surgically treated patients had a non-union, compared to about 16.5% of the individuals treated conservatively. That translates into a number needed to treat of about 7. They actually report some downsides, though, and that is that the patients who had patients needed subsequent surgery in about 17% of those who had operations to begin with. Now, some of that was because of just removing hardware that was annoying, but it also involved sort of debridement of deep wound infections. About 13% of those patients who were treated conservatively ended up getting surgery to repair a non-union. So that would work out to be a number needed to harm of about 26. So there are some trade-offs. What happened in terms of function? Well, only 3 of the studies reported function improvement, but these were based on a score, and it's not clear from the reporting whether or not these differences were clinically meaningful. So overall, what we find is that patients who are treated with surgery, they generally have a lower rate of malunion, and in this meta-analysis, a better functional outcome at the rate of higher subsequent surgeries. Now, this past January a year ago, the Cochrane did a review and came to very similar conclusions. Quote, there is low quality evidence that surgical treatment has no additional benefit in terms of function, pain, and quality of life compared with conservative treatment, but may result in fewer treatment failures overall. So in other words, what we have here are major trade-offs. To me, this is the perfect place for shared decision-making, where we can help sit down with our patients, present the data, get a sense as to what's more important to them. What are they more fearful of, subsequent surgeries, non-union, or function?
Interesting. And, you know, it seems like whenever these orthopedic surgeons study a surgical procedure, they find that it isn't quite as awesome as they thought it was for, you know, whether it's knees, hips, or clavicles. I remember my friend, who's now a family physician, when he broke his clavicle when we were overseas, and, you know, going in to get his figure of eight bandage tightened up and adjusted to, you know, yank his clavicle back, and having to drag him down to the bar for some pain management afterwards. John, any comments?
No, well said. Yeah, I think the trade-off is there. It's need to get the patients involved in shared decision-making for sure.
Yeah, and it's going to depend a lot on, you know, how active they are, what their other comorbidities are, their surgical risks, things like that. A young, healthy athlete, you might well want to, you know, lean more towards surgery. Someone old and decrepit like me, maybe less so. John, I think it's time for your poem.
Yes, my study asks and answers the clinical question, is acetaminophen, which is paracetamol, effective as an analgesic? So a very basic question. This was published in British Medical Journal in 2019, volume 367, and here are the results. The authors searched 3 different databases, including Cochrane, of course, to identify studies that were randomized trials of acetaminophen compared to placebo for pain relief. They based their findings largely on a Cochrane review of 8 studies that had 5,890 patients. And in those studies, they found that acetaminophen is effective for the treatment of episodic tension type headaches, though the effect size was pretty small. The number needed to treat was 22. They also found that it was effective, though based on some low quality evidence, for complete pain relief of acute migraine with a number needed to treat of 12. And there was also some relief of migraine at 2 hours with a number needed to treat of 5. Finally, a single dose was twice as likely as placebo to decrease perineal pain postpartum. And some patients with renal colic experienced some pain. That was just on one trial. Importantly, though, acetaminophen has not been shown to be effective for patients with acute low back pain or pain due to chronic knee or hip osteoarthritis. Now, it's surprising that even though acetaminophen has been available for many, many years, that there are so few studies of acetaminophen's effectiveness. I thought, however, it would be important to talk about this study today because there is some controversy about using ibuprofen for COVID-19 infections. There's some evidence that it can be harmful in these patients, although it certainly is not proven. But those stories might cause patients, doctors, and nurses to rely on acetaminophen for pain relief rather than NSAIDs. And as we've seen, acetaminophen probably has little effectiveness for musculoskeletal pains and achiness, which is what you would probably use it for with COVID infection. It does, however, work with fever. So to the extent that a person is uncomfortable with fever, acetaminophen is just fine. I'm wondering, Henry and Mark, what your take is on using NSAIDs for COVID patients. I know that's not the title. That's not what this is about, but I think this is an important issue.
Yeah, there was my understanding is, and I tried to dig into where this came from, is that there was a report, a letter to, I think, Lancet Infectious Disease by a physician in France who observed that he or she had four patients who were with COVID-19 and who deteriorated rather rapidly, and all four were taking ibuprofen. So it is the worst kind of evidence, but that was published kind of picked up, and they interviewed some experts, basic scientists, who said, yeah, you know, we can think of some reasons why. I mean, a basic scientist, I'm sorry, they can always find a biochemical pathway to explain everything, whether or not it's in both directions usually. And, you know, we've seen the same thing with ACE inhibitors and ARBs, where people have said, well, the coronavirus attaches to angiotensin receptors, therefore, if you're on an ACE inhibitor, you've upregulated those receptors, therefore, you're going to get sicker, therefore, you should stop taking your ACE inhibitor immediately, which is patently ridiculous, I think. I may be proven wrong, but as of this, you know, recording, no good evidence of either of those being harmful. Sure, if you want to be careful, ibuprofen, I mean, acetaminophen is safer than ibuprofen for other reasons. No reason not to use that. But I guess I'm a little skeptical of that. I don't know. What do you think, Henry?
So I agree with the basic assumption that the challenges of being able to look physiologically at what happens at either the cellular level or histopathologically doesn't always translate to clinical importance. I have taught from time to time to our medical students. We have some sessions on renal physiology, and NSAID-induced nephropathy is one of the things that we often talk about. And NSAIDs are challenging at several levels, the direct effect on nephrons, as well as their effects on afferent arterioles. And so you add something where maybe renal flow might be impaired, and you've also got an acute illness, whether it's COVID-19 or urinary tract infection or what have you, that may also impair levels of hydration. You end up with this potential additive effect. These are all theoretical. Whether or not these are truly effects on intact humans remains to be seen. To me, this really is a balance of benefits and harms. And so if something is truly effective, then you have to think about using that primarily. Acetaminophen, it's very, very safe compared to the NSAIDs. You think about what are the main concerns about acetaminophen use? It's high dose over long-term use and its effects on kidney on liver. So I think with regards to pain relief, we should be thinking about using acetaminophen selectively. There may be some genetic predispositions to responders versus non-responders. If it doesn't work, you'll know within a couple of doses, and then you move on to the next thing. That's how safe this stuff is.
Right. And I think that's good practical advice for our listeners, who I'm sure are interested in practical advice at this time. So acetaminophen's worth a try. If it doesn't work, move on to something else. And if you have concern about an NSAID, tramadol is probably equally effective, and if used cautiously, should be safe for a short period of time.
Okay. Henry, I think you have a recommendation for our listeners before we wrap up.
Yeah, this is our, we're trying to do a little bit more of art or literary recommendations. And my recommendation is A.J. Cronin's 1937 book, The Citadel. Cronin tells the story of a young idealistic physician, Andrew Manson, who cares for a coal mining community in Wales. And while he's there, he's really thoughtful and observant and happens to notice this relationship between mining exposures and silicosis. And this takes him on to become a bit more famous about this. And as his career evolves, he kind of loses his way and becomes seduced by the money he could get from wealthy patients in London. And while in London, he observes all kinds of crazy things with his practice and actually ends up being put on trial for practicing phthisis in the care of a patient with tuberculosis. But you know, during this whole process, he refines himself and ends up going back full circle to his coal mining community in Wales. Now, Cronin was a physician and was interviewed after writing the book. And the quote that I have here is that I have written in the Citadel all I feel about the medical profession, its injustices, its hidebound, unscientific stubbornness, its humbug, the horrors and inequities detailed in the story that I have personally witnessed. This is not an attack against individuals, but against a system. Some people actually say that this book was the foundation for creating the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. Now, there are a whole bunch of movies that were made. I have not actually seen any of these. I've only ever read the book. My wife, Terry, gave me a copy on Valentine's Day in 1984, the year before I went to practice in a little coal mining community in West Virginia. And I've reread it about every 4 or 5 years. And each time I read it, it's at a different stage in my career. And the book has a different meaning. It's one of these things that just kind of puts us in touch. Why did we get into medicine in the first place? It's for the same reasons I mentioned the beginning. It's not about us. It's about caring for individuals. It's about our altruism. And eventually we will find our way through this COVID-19 with all of the crazy politics that are out there on both sides of the aisle. I am still confident that the American public, we will find our way through this and get through it.
Thank you, Henry. As Churchill said, the Americans will do the right thing in the end after exhausting all other possibilities, I think was what he said.
Yes.
Something like that, to paraphrase Winston. Anyway, thank you guys for joining me. Thank you, audience, for listening in. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Please tell your friends, rate us on iTunes, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.